changing. We're flying high, creating a complaint-free world. No more, no more complaining people. Their lives are changing. We're flying high, creating a complaint-free world. No more, no more.
Well, I'm going to get right to my guest here, and I'm excited to be talking with him. His name is Dr. Amakongo Dibenge. He is the founding director of Upstander International, an organization designed to help individuals and organizations take a stand against injustice wherever they see it. He conducts trainings and provides keynote speeches on issues related to diversity, equity, and inclusion. He is the professor of international communication at American University. He's also an accomplished trilingual rapper. How cool is that? A trilingual rapper. I can't even rap in English. Dr. Dibenge, welcome. It's nice to have you here with us.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here. So I want to celebrate everybody's greatness. So let's start off with this poem, especially when we're talking about stopping, complaining, and being great. This poem I wrote is called Grow Towards Your Greatness. They say that greatness is a choice, but what have you chosen? You've been frozen in time and broken in mind. For too long, the same song playing in your head, living in breath, but better off dead. But who said that you didn't have the power? Who said this is not your hour? You've been showered with a steady stream of words that kill your dreams. But since you're still breathing, then someone has lied to you, tried to deny you of your own potential inside you. If you just decide to, let no one deride you. Don't even let them get beside you as you unearth the new you. Stop listening to naysayers and decide to do you. No more pity parties, sob stories, and boo-hoos. If no one told you that you're great, then let me be the first to. If you develop the thirst to drink from face fountain, you'll develop the might to move mountains. You see, we remove tons of dirt to find 1 ounce of gold. So I ask you to remove tons of hurt and just uncover 1 ounce of your soul. You'll set yourself on a true path of excellence, getting out of your passenger seat and driving your own car, reaching for the moon, but maybe only landing among the stars. You see, you have greatness inside you, but you must choose to be great. Blaze a path of excellence, leaving fear in your wake. All you need is already inside you. You just must believe in yourself. Grow towards your greatness and discover your true wealth.
I want to know why critical race theory has become such an important thing that everybody is talking about and why it is polarizing people, in your opinion, and what we can look to in the future for that.
Yeah. Wow. I live for these discussions. So look, at the end of the day, one of the things I talk about in my class is this thing called agnotology. And agnotology is a study about how doubt is produced. It's a study of culturally induced doubt. One of the great examples of it is the smoking industry in the 1960s. When people realized that they couldn't challenge the health risk of tobacco, they basically just said, well, doubt is going to be our product. So you put celebrities in advertisements, people start thinking, well, if celebrities do it, and it must be cool. And then all of a sudden you start doubting. So when we come up to today, when we talk about critical race theory, people are using critical race theory as a wedge, but they don't understand what it actually is. They are using it as a way to create doubt, to get people doubting the importance of studying everybody's history, to get people to start doubting the importance of creating communities where everybody can be celebrated and not tolerated. And the challenge with this, well, is that most people who are talking about critical race theory don't know what it actually is. I do. Critical race theory came out of Harvard University. It was created by activists and law school professors for law school students. And as somebody who works in K-12 schools, public charter and private schools, who talks to kids, parents, and teachers, I can tell you that it's not something that is being taught in schools. We are in the world of code words now, and people are using CRT, which should be talking about culturally responsive teaching. They're using that as code to ban the teaching of history of non-white, heterosexual, wealthy males in our school curriculum.
It's interesting because I began this jumpstart by talking about people making very strong comments about Will Smith or Chris Rock. And really, a lot of the people that I did talk to, did you watch it? No. Did you watch the background? No. Did you do any research on this? No. But you have a very strong opinion. And the same is true for critical race theory. And I'm sure that while I was working on my headphones, you defined it. Give me the definition, if you would, because I quickly so I can jump on that. Would you please?
No problem. And just a quick thing. My name's pronounced Omekongo Dibinga.
Dibinga. My apologies. Thank you.
So here's a very short definition that everybody can use of critical race theory. Critical race theory is the study of policies in the United States and their impact from a racial lens. That's all it is.
Wow.
If you can't live in this housing area in the 60s, how did that impact Black people? How did it impact white people? If you can't work at this job, how did that affect Asian people? Because you couldn't work there because you were Asian. It's the study of those effects of America's policies. That's all.
I'm actually reading Uncle Tom's Cabin for the very first time right now. Mm-hmm. And I have to take it in very small doses because it's hard to listen to. And I grew up, and I've shared my history in this, I grew up in a privileged, all-white, upper middle-class society. I never knew an African-American who didn't work for my family until I was in college. Mm-hmm. And my father was actually in minstrel shows.
Wow.
So, yeah, but what this ties back to what you were talking about. My father not only was in minstrel shows, but he didn't fix cars for a living. My father was the executive director of the South Carolina Savings and Loan League, which is where people would go to get homes.
Yes.
And so what a message that was sending to the African American community that these presidents of savings and loans were there doing this burlesque on African Americans. So, but my question, I guess, is why I can see that. You know what I mean? And I can see how wrong that was. Why do so many people resist it out of hand? Is it the politicization, or do people genuinely have an issue with taking a more balanced view of history?
Well, the challenge is that people look at any type of change as a personal attack on their way of life. And they want to keep some form of nostalgia that quite honestly never existed. When people talk about things like, you know, we want to make America great again. But the question becomes, when was it great? Because I believe this country is great. But at every moment we've had greatness, it hasn't been great for everybody. So when you go back to certain times, well, Black people couldn't vote here, women couldn't vote there, gay people couldn't marry there. So it's that nostalgia that's not really true. And so when people are talking about it being such a visceral reaction, I'll share a quotation that I'm sure you're aware of from Lyndon Johnson, because what happens is people are working against their own self-interest right now. He said, "I learned at a young age that when you could convince the poorest white man that he's better than the best colored man, he won't realize you're picking his pocket. Give him someone to look down on and he'll empty his pockets for you." So as long as you can create wedge issues like this, you get people focused on, well, at least other people are suffering more than I am. And so you don't really pay attention to your own issues. You have poor white people in rural areas of Kentucky who need health care, but will forego it because it came from President Obama. And they'd rather see nobody get health care than them get access to it. And that's what is happening right here. People are so caught up in this being a zero-sum game. By teaching Black history, I lose on white history, as opposed to realizing that this is all American history, that they're willing to fight to the death for it.
And you're still hearing me okay, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Good. How does critical race theory feed into social injustice in our country?
Well, when you look at critical race theory, and once again, this is something that is created by legal scholars for law school students, it looks at how can you understand the past so that you can better create policies for now and the future. James Baldwin said, if you don't understand what happened behind you, you can't understand what's happening around you. So you bring up the example of your father, and there's a great book called The Color of Money by Mercer Baradaran. And you look at Richard Rothstein's The Color of Law, and we understand that discrimination was written into every policy in America, including banking policies. It was on the books that you couldn't give loans to Black people, to Jewish people. You know, the list goes on and on. And so if you're coming out of World War II and you're a soldier, you get to take advantage of the GI Bill. You get access to better access to housing, to loans, to job opportunities, to education, except if you're a Black soldier. So critical race theory will look at what happened with the disparities of how white soldiers coming from World War II were able to start building wealth at an earlier age than Black people and how that affects us today. If we don't understand the past, we can't course correct for the future.
You know, it's interesting. I once saw, I think it was on 60 Minutes or something like that, but they took a stack of photographs and it was Black men and white men. And they went through and they asked them to assign either a positive, they gave them a choice of two words, positive or negative, and for each one. And by far, the negative pile was stacked higher with Black images. The interesting thing was, though, they then gave the same test to Black people yes. and asked them to do it. And they also assigned the negative things. It is simply so ingrained in the culture. I'm speaking as a person who doesn't understand it at all, but it seems to be so ingrained in the culture that it is something that we've got a lot of time to make up for. And sports athletes and television stars, et cetera, is not just the answer. It's a multi-pronged understanding. I once read this thing that said the reason white people, and I love this because I'm white and I can say all this. I'm so white, I glow. that the reason white people are so concerned about being in the minority here in this country is they know how poorly minorities were treated. And I think that there's a lot of truth in that. I think there's a lot of fear of a shift of power that people don't even understand completely. Am I off base here?
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. And there's this fear that people who are not white will do what happened to them to white people.
Right.
And there's a great educator, scholar, white woman, Jane Elliott. You know, she did the brown eye, blue eye test in schools. And she got fired for her work. Great activist. And she's an elder in our community, white woman. And one of the things she did in a video is she said to a group of white people, how many of you all would choose to give up your whiteness or something to that effect? And nobody in the audience raised their hand. And she said, that proves that you know what Black people are dealing with. Mm. And that's why you don't want to give it up. And one of the things I'm looking at in my book that's coming out called 10 Lies About Black People is that we have to understand is that these lies that are told, these stories that are told, going exactly to your example, they affect all of us. It's not just white people who have negative views about Black people. Black people have been, as Joe Madison talks about, culturally conditioned to believe that they're inferior as well. Not all Black people, what we're talking about. Society has done this as relates to how we look at our hair, our skin color, all of these issues. And if we really want to course correct, we have to have an honest assessment about history. That's what my book is going to look at. That's what Jane Elliott talks about. And that's what everybody who you're talking about is speaking about. And to be quite honest, Will, this goes to the core of your message as well. When you talk about, you know, not complaining, and you talk about the gripe model and how the first thing is about that G, get attention. We all want attention to be recognized for the beauty of who we are. We all want to be treated as human beings, equal under the law, and we all want to be celebrated and not tolerated and not discriminated against. It's a fundamental human issue, and more people should understand that in this society.
And what is amazing is how, if you're not living it, it's difficult to fully understand.
That's right. That's right. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And even like, again, listening to Uncle Tom's Cabin, I'm listening to the audiobook, and the enslaved people quoting the Bible to one another as to why they should be enslaved because they were brought up that way. And it's just amazing how the word belief means something we have decided is true. And so at some point, we've decided all of these little things about race, et cetera, et cetera. One of the most negatively commented on things that I ever said was that I am a privileged white male. Oh, my gosh, people went crazy about that. Yeah. And I was like, just look at the history and add to the fact that I'm tall and I'm about as privileged as you. Well, if I had hair, like yours, especially. Anyway, so you teach individuals and associations, et cetera, in speaking and in through your classes. I got two questions here, but what can we do? What can we as individuals do instead of doom scrolling Reddit going, ain't it awful, ain't it awful, ain't it awful? What practical steps? I live in a part of Florida that is Trump country, and there is a group of maybe five or six elderly women who stand on the corner in front of the Catholic Church with a sign that says Black Lives Matter at 5 o'clock on Friday. So tell me what we can do that's going to be, make us feel like we're contributing and also impacting.
Well, one of the things we have to understand is we have to look at what interpretation we're going by. When you talk about the example of enslaved individuals, you know, many of those who were enslaved, you know, who got to read the Bible on their own, realized it was all about liberation, right? So it's like how the interpretation went towards them, right? It's really interesting. This is what I would encourage everybody to do. And everybody can do this right now, you know, because we need, as I talk about, you know, as my shirt says, more upstanders and not bystanders. Those women standing in front of that church, they're upstanders, right? So I challenge everybody to engage in this. And I wrote an article, it's on my blog, upstanderinternational.com. It's called The Rule of Seven. And I want everybody to ask ourselves seven questions to see how really committed you are to diversity, equity, and inclusion. Now, we're not gonna go through all of them, but let's look at some of them. And you can make up your own questions.
Okay.
What do your seven neighbors look like? What do the authors of, and you can't change your neighbors today, but you can change this one. What do the authors of the last seven books you read look like? What does the cast of the last seven shows that you went to in Broadway or in the theater in your area look like? Who are the hosts of the last seven podcasts that you listen to? You have kids in your life, hopefully one of them as well, you know, as well. You could definitely add in the Upstanders podcast as well. If you got children in your lives, what do the last seven toys that you brought look like, bought for them? What does the cast members of the last seven shows you watch and they watch look like? You're at work. What do your seven co-workers look like? The seven leaders of your team? Why do I ask these questions? Well, because it gets to see that on a daily basis, what are you doing in your own life? If you say you're committed to this, to start to change the perspectives that you're introducing. None of us right now are going to change laws, get bills signed and all of that, or change a politician unless, you know, we vote, of course. But there are things you can do every single day. I'll give you an example right now. Growing up in my work, as somebody who calls myself an expert in diversity, equity, and inclusion, I had to realize that there was not a lot that I knew about people who are part of what we call the disabled community. And I'm not a big fan of that word. I like differently abled and the like. And so I had to go and start looking at who I was listening to, who I was reading, what opinions. We're having a big debate about the transgender community. How many transgender people do you actually know? You know, I've actually started to have transgender people in my classes. And so I've had to learn more, reading authors, transgender authors and the like. Every day we have an opportunity to be on a constant path of learning. Yes, I'm a teacher, but I love being educated more. And those are things that we can all do right now if we are seriously committed to having this conversation and doing the work.
I love that. And I think that's a great, it is simply our exposure. I know that I was part of a spiritual cinema group and we were watching the movie Loving, which is about, of course, the Loving family, which was illegal for them to be married. And in the state of Virginia, and they were forced to leave immediately, et cetera. And then I started just diving into as many African-American related movies as I could. Marshall, 12 Years a Slave, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it does change your perspective. And those media choices are important. And books as well. Books as well. So that we begin to have a more holistic experience. The name of your book, again, is 10 Myths About Black People.
10 Lies About Black People.
10 Lies About Black People. And can you share a few?
Yeah. So what we're doing, and it's coming out in the spring of next year, currently writing it right now. I'm very excited to be writing this. And what we're looking at is how myths that have been told about Black people have not only hurt Black people, but the entire community. When you deny Black people the opportunity to do things like be in medical school or be doctors and the like, you're losing the opportunity to create things like cures for cancer, cure for AIDS at an earlier state. Look at all the Black inventions that have come out of the 1800s and the 1900s and even now that have helped this community, our society. There are so many things from the technology used from the cell phone to the refrigerator to the traffic light, the gas mask that have helped the entire community. Furthermore, when you deny Black people an opportunity to live in a community, what stereotypes do you allow to fester that will manifest themselves when these communities start to encounter each other? When you look at situations like our education, when you have a system that teaches that Black people are inherently inferior, how does that help create grown-up policymakers who base their opinions of how they treat Black people? Then we end up getting an Obama where people who have never lived next to a Black person, who have never had to learn that Black people were intelligent, now have to be led by a Black person. And then you start getting things like the Tea Party and the fight, and because people were always taught the lie that Black people were naturally inferior. So we're looking at all of those things from a societal and historical perspective, and then we're going to give real solutions like the Rule of Seven of what we can do as a community to start to build something better, because our whole society has been built on these lies. Slavery was based on a lie. And we can change the if Jim Crow was based on a lie, right? All of these issues that what we're looking at right now, the society, the big lie, these lies have worked to destroy our society. And 10 Lies About Black People is going to look at challenging all of that. And we can all challenge it.
I have a friend who I don't engage with socially anymore because we both went to the same all-white high school, private high school in South Carolina. And I feel like in many ways he's still there. And he would send me these racist things. And when I would point it out somewhat calmly and somewhat vociferously, I'm not racist. And one of the things that I've discovered, there was a woman I met here in Key Largo, and she started rambling this stuff off. And I was like, that's pretty rare. Why do, in your opinion, do people who are racist don't see it? And why do they react so bombastically when you point it out to them?
Because, well, man, I'm so glad you brought this up. Because we have a limited vision of what racism is. And so we look at racism, we only think about crosses burning and enslaving people. And one of the things I encourage people to do when I go to corporations, schools, government groups, and I say, you all have to have a diversity dictionary. And what I mean by that is that you need to have agreed upon definitions about the terms you are talking about. It's just like diversity. When we think about diversity, most people think race and gender, but there's so much diversity, diversity of thought, diversity of political affiliation, class, religion, etc. And so you're working off one definition of racism and your former friend slash colleague is working off a different definition. When we come to the same definitions, we can work from there. It's like sports. That's the easiest example. If we ask who the greatest basketball player is, you're going to have your person. I'm going to have my person. Someone's going to say Jordan. Someone's going to say, some people will say LeBron. I don't know why they would.
I don't either. LeBron's great. Let's leave it at Jordan. Okay.
I love him. But here's the thing. You know, we'll get into fist fights over this stuff, right?
Right.
But once you set the criteria, there's no debate. If you say it's based on who scored the most points, currently it's Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. If you say it's on who won the most championships, it's Bill Russell. There's no debate. And so when you set the definitions, and sometimes you have to spend more time as a family, as a community, as a workforce, working on the definitions, because once you get the definitions, you can point it out easily. Now, if people still want to deny it, then that's more work that they have to do. If you say, I'm not racist, I just believe that white people are naturally smarter than Black people, then that's a racist idea that you have to work to challenge. You're not implementing systemic racism. There's a difference between a racist idea, individual racism, and systemic racism. But no, many of us in this country are not equipped to have those types of conversations well. So we have to have set definitions and then build from there.
That is so true. When I do bring these things up to him, one of his comments is, Black people are more racist than we are. And yet when I'm asking him to share more about that, it falls flat.
Yes.
I wonder, that in and of itself seems defensive. It's almost like, I'm not, you are.
Yes.
Why do you think that is? Is that what it is? Is people are just being defensive?
Absolutely, because you're talking about an individual racist in action, and that person switches it to society, putting the blame on other people. And the fact of the matter is, the one of the reasons we're not getting where we need to as a society, you know, Oprah talks about this, Dr. Maya Angelou talks about this, you know, before she passed, you know, I honor her so much. You know, my rap name is actually Young Maya. Young Maya.
No!
African, Mighty African Youth Advocate, M-A-Y-A. She saved my life as a child. So, you know, when I saw everything you're doing, I'm like, we are there, bro. We are there. But people deflect because in society, people don't want to do the real self-reflective work to understand society. So when we come to racism, oh, well, my dad worked as a white person. You know, my dad worked hard too. I used to say, you know, just because he was able and he pulled himself up by the bootstraps. Yeah, your dad worked hard and was able to get a loan. But can we talk about the fact that my dad couldn't get access to that loan simply because of his race? Like, people don't want to admit that because they feel like it kind of discredits the things that they did. And I don't want to discredit anything that white people did to get to where they are. But you have to understand that you started at level two, while other groups were starting at level negative one. And that's not taking anything away from you. And so that's why people are doing that, because it's a visceral thing. You're saying, I didn't earn what I got. You're saying that those people may not be where they are because of something my ancestors did, something I might be doing right now. I'm just saying, you know, and that hurts because people don't want to fundamentally believe that. And quite honestly, that's why people are working to get this stuff not taught in schools. Right now in our schools, in some of our schools, you can teach that Jackie Robinson was the first black player in Major League Baseball, but you can't teach why there were no black players before him. You can talk about Dr. King made a great speech about he had a dream, but you can't talk about the nightmare that led him to talk about having a dream in the first place. That's what people want to do right now. And fundamentally, they want to get rid of all of that so people can continue placing the blame on those people, quote unquote, for not being able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, even though in many situations they didn't have boots to begin with.
Wow. We can teach Dr. King. We can't teach Emmett Till. Thank you for the work you're doing. It's important work. I don't remember where I read the quote, and I know this would be more appropriate in the 1800s, but it's that the slave and the master are partners in misery. And yes. I think we need to all heal from that misery and to move forward. So
that's right.
Thank you so much. And thanks everybody for being with us. Be sure and click share and share this message with other people, because there's a lot of people that are going to want to hear about it. Enjoy today, and I look forward to seeing you tomorrow. Thanks. Bye-bye.
No more, no more complaining people. Their lives are changing. We're flying high, creating a complaint-free world. No more, no more complaining people. Their lives are changing. We're flying high, creating a complaint-free world.